Michael Nicholson, and this is Reel 21.
Well, my second visit to Angola ended in an astonishing scoop for me, one of the great scoops of my own career. And for Savimbi, it ended in disaster, because he lost a vital military victory and also a crucial ally, South Africa. And I remember it began with my fascination over a white leg. What happened was that we had landed we had been taken to again to Wambo. It was the governor's palace, governor's house, wonderful place, glorious building, typical Portuguese, ornate tiling and beautiful vaulting. When I went back many years later, it had been absolutely demolished. And we were told to stay there while our program. Whenever you go to these countries, there's always a program. They ask you what you want to do, and then they some days later come back with a program. And you have to get up at a certain time on a certain day, and they'll take you there, and you'll meet this person, and then you'll have lunch, and then you... It's all... None of it works, of course, but that's how they start. That's how you start with your program. So we were waiting for our program, and we waited and waited. And it's always occurred to me that waiting is a favourite pastime in Africa. You know, it saves you doing anything. If you can stand in a queue, you have a reason to do nothing. So while Alan and John Hunt, Alan was my cameraman, Alan Downs, and John Hunt was the sound recorder, were playing table tennis in the governor's house, I decided to walk to the airport. And it was empty. I started to look around, and suddenly I saw an open door. And as I walked into the... I knocked, but as I walked in, because I could hear people talking inside, I suddenly saw a white leg kind of resting against the table. And as I tried to push my way in, an Angolan came, and you could see the kind of horror on his face. And he just pushed me out and slammed the door. And I got back, I walked back the mile and a half back to the governor's house, and I said to Alan, "Do you know, I think the South Africans are here." He said, "Why did you say that?" I said, "I've just seen a man's leg in shorts. It's a white leg, and he's got socks up to his knees. And in the sock is a comb." Now, remember, I was living in South Africa at the time. I'd been there a year already. And the South Africans, like the Rhodesians men, are very fond to wear these knee-length socks. And the more... vein among them, tuck a comb in to the top. And I said, "That's what I'd seen." So Alan said, "He's South African because he has a pair of socks on." I said, "No. You know, no other white man in Africa dresses that way. It's either a Rhodesian or a South African." I says, "He could have been an arms dealer. He could have been another journalist, but, you know, had it been so, I couldn't understand why this sudden panic in the man's face and just shut the door so fast." So, you know, one of the things about journalism, you quite often try and make the facts fit the story, but also you work on another level where, you know, you just follow your nose. And I've got a rather long nose, and it's been very helpful over the years. And I just had this feeling that I'd seen a South African. That could only mean one thing: the South African army was in Angola fighting for Savimbi, which is astonishing, because time and time again they had denied it. So I was very exhilarated by this. Next day, again, there was no reason why the South Africans, of course, were alerted. They didn't know that any press were in the area. But we passed a convoy of camouflage Panhard armoured cars with white uniformed troops around them in the turrets. Now, these weren't mercenaries. Mercenaries, I've seen the world over, ragbag guys, long hair, dirty, unshaven, cigarettes, all kinds of different uniforms. Anything they have that's kept clean and working is their rifles. These guys were young, close-cropped hair, smart uniforms, disciplined. These were South Africans. This was a South African conscript army. So there we had proof that we didn't have it on camera because we were travelling too fast. But then, again, with the luck that's always been trademark for me, it was arranged that we should fly a few days later to Lobito, which is on the coast. Savimbi was keen to show just how much territory he now controlled, right the way across southern Angola to the coast at Lobito. Now, the pilot was Anglo-Portuguese, Angolan-Portuguese, and for some reason he had decided to stay on when the rest of the Portuguese had fled. Let me just remind you, I've forgotten to tell you that we'd actually filmed the aftermath of the Portuguese evacuation. We weren't in time, we didn't actually see the evacuation, but we saw the aftermath. Quite astonishing. People were leaving in such bitterness that they left behind a kind of burnt earth, scorched earth. A lot of them burnt their own houses so the blacks wouldn't have them. They killed their own cattle so the blacks wouldn't have them. Mutilated their own cattle, cut the hamstrings so the blacks wouldn't have them. And on the road to the airport, was littered, literally littered, either side, with furniture, fridges, television sets, washing machines, which they thought they'd be able to take out of the country. And at the airport, the hangars were stacked to the roof with personal belongings, because once they got to the airport, all they were allowed to carry out was what they could carry, their handbags and their luggage. It was quite astonishing, this great mountain of household goods that the Portuguese thought they could take back to Portugal with them. Anyway, this pilot, who was in a flyer to Lobito, was an Angolan Portuguese, stayed behind for reasons which we discovered later. Now, we were flying in the UNITAS Fokker Friendship, but mid-air, instead of flying to Lobito, he suddenly told us that he was going to divert to Quito Canavale, which was actually further south and off our route. He didn't say why, except that he was on urgent personal business. We landed at Quito Canavale, and he got a bus to take us into town where he said we'd have to wait. Really, just the three of us, Alan, John and myself. Now, on the way in on that bus into town, we passed another one of these convoys, which was stationary by the road. Panhard armored cars. I knew them. I'd seen them in South Africa many times. And sure enough, South African soldiers there. It happened too quickly for us to film it, but we just prayed that on our way back to the airstrip, we'd come back on that same road. We waited in the hotel, and then it became obvious why the pilot was so keen to divert. He came out looking rather flushed and breathless, with a very sweet little girl, at least half his age, a mulatto. Having kissed her goodbye, off we went back down the road, and thank God, and along the same road. Alan, I noticed in the hotel while we were waiting, was practicing with his camera on his shoulder, getting his arm in position, so when we stopped the coach, and we would stop the coach, I'd make sure we would, we had a film, switch on a wide-angle lens, and then look away and talk to me so that nobody would believe that he was filming. It's very clever of him. We got to the Panhards again. Shouted to the driver to stop. The pilot said, no, don't stop. But I actually started to kick up a fuss and shout and scream, and stopped. I tried to get out of the coach, knowing they'd never let me, but I tried to get out. Up came the South African young captain, and I started to speak in English to him. He almost spoke back in English to me and then reverted to Afrikaans, which was silly of him, because I recognized the Afrikaans straight away. told us to get back in the bus. I carried on creating a disturbance simply to give Alan more time to film. And anyway, off we went. There was our proof. I'd heard an Afrikaner speaking. I'd seen his uniform. All the insignias had been ripped off. And I'd seen brand new pan-armored cars, discipline trips. There was my proof that the South Africans were there. I mean, they didn't have to have, you know, Van Heerden or Van der Merwe or Butter stenciled on their uniform for me to know who they were. Just stop there for a second. It was. It was astonishing. Okay. So, we interviewed Savimbi, but of course I couldn't mention that we'd got this picture because he would have confiscated everything off us, of course. So I had to get rid of our pictures before we could carry on with our story. That meant flying back to Lusaka, which is the nearest airport. We were flying, by the way, in Tiny Rowland's own jet. He had loaned it to UNITA. It became a taxi cab for us and many other people that Tiny Rowlands wanted in and out of Angola, mostly business people and gun runners and people like that. So I had to get our film back to Lusaka and ship it to London. And I called my editor, and in a fairly coded way, because I wasn't certain whether the phones were tapped. I don't suppose they were. They weren't that efficient. And nor did I know the Zambian government's attitude to it also. You know, I couldn't take any risk of losing this film, but I intimated to my foreign editor, John Marnie, that we had this, this scoop. But, you know, I was still pretty young there. So I was 75, remember. I was still uncertain of what I'd got. Uncertain to the point that I didn't think I'd had enough to convince everybody that what I thought knew to be true was true. And so I made a fatal mistake. I say fatally, it was just something I shouldn't have done. One of the things you learn in a business is that your bosses will not believe their own people. I knew that to be a fact from previous stories. It's only if they read it on tape, Reuters, PA, AP, that they'll believe the story. They'd rather believe the story from an unknown reporter, that is a reporter unknown to them because it appears on tape, than their own reporter. So I thought, well, what I need to do is get somebody else in on this story, and then my office will believe it. And I contacted a guy called Fred Bridgeland, who was the Reuters correspondent in Lusaka at the time, and I told him what I'd seen. Of course, he was terribly excited. And I said, look, I'll let you come with me on my next trip in on the understanding that you file only on the day that my story is transmitted. I do not want you to scoop me. So he agreed. And he was a man of his word. So I arranged the flight back for him and us and the crew. It was the same aircraft, HS-125. And as it turned out, it was a British crew. One was an Air Force pilot, former RAF pilot, one was a former Fleet Air Arm pilot. Got on very well with them. And instead of flying straight back into Wambo, or Nova Lisboa, we stopped on the way. And we stopped just inside Angola. Just on the Southwest Africa. It was Southwest Africa then. It's Namibia today, but it was the Southwest Africa, which is under the control of the South Africans, of course. But just inside Angola, this huge airstrip, makeshift airstrip, and it was full of military hardware. Armored cars, tanks, field guns, howitzers, mortars of all calibers, jeeps, ammunition trucks, and troops. White troops. And they were all being loaded in aboard unmarked Hercules air transporters. Now this, we landed and we were told not to put our heads above the window, but you know, it was too much to ignore. this was obviously the South Africans' main transit base across the Okavango River. And they would not be pouring this kind of troop and supplies into Angola unless they were there in a big way. It was obvious. And that's when I thought I should never have told Bridgeland, because here I have absolute truth. And it would have been my world exclusive. And there, damage was done. So I knew what effect these disclosures would have once they were transmitted. So the South Africans, once it was made known that they were there, would have to pull out. And Savimbi would not survive. Excuse me. Now, it was a dilemma for me because, you know, I did not want the MPLA Cubans, the communists, to take over Angola. My sympathies were with Savimbi. It would have suited the West, and that includes me, very well to have had him in place in as president of Angola, rather than a pro-Marxist, pro-Soviet, pro-Cuban president of the MPLA. But I knew that once my pictures and my story were shown, Savimbi would lose the one ally that could give him the presidency. And the South Africans had to leave. So that was my dilemma. And of course I had no choice but to go ahead and publish. So the story went out on News at 10. Fred Bridgeland's story went out on all the world newspapers. The world newspapers published stills from our own film. And it was interesting that the Rand Daily Mail and the Johannesburg Star printed blank front pages. The story was censored, totally censored in South Africa. And I've still got the front page of the Rand Daily Mail, which says South African troops in Angola, and then a blank front page. The pictures and the story had been... a little inquisitiveness about a man's white leg and the... a romantic affair by a middle-aged Angolan with a little 20-year-old mulatto gave me one of my biggest ever scoops.
It's interesting, that dilemma, really, isn't it? You know, how one judges what to do.
Well, you have no choice, do you? I mean, you don't have a choice. I think many journalists are confronted with that many, many times. I mean, in politics especially, if a pro-Tory or a pro-Labour journalist is writing for a pro-Tory or pro-Labour newspaper, suddenly comes across a story that's going to damage the party that perhaps he supported all his life, he has no choice but to reveal that story. I mean, that's his job. And that was my dilemma then. I knew that it was going to damage Savimbi. Of course, once my film was in London, and it was safe, I then confronted Savimbi, who was a little taken aback by it all, still insisting that they were mercenaries. Even when I said, Mr. Savimbi, Dr. Savimbi, I know a South African conscript when I see one, still insisted that they were mercenaries. Because mercenaries had fought in Angola for various sides throughout the War of Liberation, so-called. No, he still could not admit it, of course. But later, in later years, I met various people who'd fought, various South Africans, who'd fought in that, it was called the Tiger Battalion, and they told me that they were within 90 kilometres, 50 miles of Luanda, the capital. And Savimbi was within a day's drive of taking the capital when my story broke. And of course they turned around and left. And Savimbi's still fighting. So it just shows you what can happen when a naughty little journalist finds himself in a situation like that. We can do untold good or untold harm.
It indicates the power you have, really, doesn't it? Because, you know, obviously, had you decided otherwise, history could have been changed.
Yes, had I not been there, or had I decided not to publish, had I not taken Fred Bridgeland and had second thoughts, though of course I had my crew with me and they wouldn't have allowed me to conceal the story. Of course, Savimbi would be in power now. Yes, we do have that power, but it's accidental power, isn't it? It's power that that comes to you. And it's power you have no choice but to use. So, that was 1975, and I never went back to Angola for another 3 years. It was August, August 78. In fact, we were in Mozambique at the time, covering the Portuguese evacuation of Mozambique, or the aftermath of it, in 78.
Was it as bad?
It was as bad, yes. It wasn't quite as bloody, but it was the same chaotic, hysterical evacuation. 300 years, and they just rushed to the airport, as if there was going to be enormous bloodletting afterwards, which there wasn't. Mozambicans simply killed each other. But we were there. I remember we were kind of sunning ourselves. I finished our story there in Mozambique. I was with another crew then, Tom Phillips and Mickey Doyle. And we were sunning ourselves on the veranda of the Almirante Hotel in what was Lorenzo Marx, now Maputo. And we got a cable from the office saying Dr. Zvimbi was granting me an interview and a review of his troops. And we were to fly back to Johannesburg, kit ourselves out, and then fly to Kinshasa, where we would be met by UNITA officials and taken onwards, which is what we did. And so that August we found ourselves in Kinshasa. We landed a Swiss Air flight. We were treated like VIPs, rather sheepishly though. We were, you know, as we went down the steps of the aircraft, some hoods turned up and took us straight off to cross the tarmac into a car with no passport, no formalities, no customs, off into a hotel. We weren't allowed to sign in. It all became rather mysterious and suspicious because, you know, as far as anybody knew, we'd never landed in Kinshasa and we'd never checked into this hotel. Therefore, if anything happened to us, as was likely, you need to say, well, we never saw them. They may have caught the plane, but you know, we never saw them get off. And so I remember Mickey saying that he would carve his name into the wall of the hotel room with the date, just in case anyone, you know, a bit like the Count of Monte Cristo. Anyway, next morning, we went to the airport again into a Fokker Friendship, one we recognized from previous trips. And after a full day's flying, refueling on the way, we landed at a place called Jamba. We didn't know it then, but that was the name we discovered later, which was all the way back south again. And we'd flown all the way north to Kinshasa now. We'd flown a whole day back again, almost back to the South African border, Angolan Southwest African border. Then we immediately boarded a lorry. It was dark. We boarded a lorry. And we began a long journey north again. We were told it would be about 120 miles where we would meet Dr. Zvimbi. I remember we drove all night, open lorry, packed with soldiers, supplies. I mean, it was so packed. I remember you could sleep standing up, which I did throughout. It was a hateful, hateful journey. Guys were ragtag uniforms, but I noticed they all had good boots on, American boots, the kind of boots I recognized from Vietnam. And they all carried pretty good AK-47s, Soviet made, Czech made. Our group leader was a man called Ben. He spoke quite good English, played the guitar, had a degree. And he seemed to be in charge of us, and he told us that we were quite safe. We were travelling all the way north through what he jokingly described as Dr. Savimbi's Ho Chi Minh Trail. It was his supply trail going through the jungle. He reckoned, Ben told us, that it was such a clever route, a bit like the Ho Chi Minh Trail, that it couldn't be seen from the air. Because you remember the MPLA, who were now in control of Angola, the Marxist MPLA with Cubans, were patrolling the skies with their MiGs, and with the helicopters. Well, late that second day, we started off again. It's a boring country. The Portuguese called it the land at the end of the earth. It's huge plains, flat plains of sand and masasa grass. Every now and again you'd hit a little bit of dense bush. It really is the land of the end of the earth. It virtually nothing. It was a great cattle country in the old days. The Portuguese had these, you know, 1,000, 20,000 acres of ranch. It's kind of between the Kalahari Desert and the Okavango. Most unpleasant. Next, it must have been about 4 that following morning, and we'd been travelling all night. I was asleep. Suddenly all hell broke loose. What sounded like mortars, I thought mortars at the time. I think I wrote that they were mortars. They couldn't have been mortars. It was just heavy gunfire, machine gun fire, the crack of rifles. And the lorry suddenly skidded sideways into sand and stopped. And then all I can remember is just pushing my head as far into these rucksacks as I could, as all hell was breaking loose around us. It was just totally chaotic. I didn't know what the hell was going on. What was even harder for me is that Tom and Jerry were sitting in the cab with the driver, and I was in the back. So I didn't have any idea whether they were safe, and they didn't know whether I was safe. Guys were jumping out over the side. It was an ambush. Cuban MPLA ambush. I was alone in the lorry, and I saw there was an AK rifle within the yard of me, and I had this idiotic impulse to kind of grab it, stand up, and open fire myself. It just shows you just how absurd, how contaminated we are with Hollywood fantasies, because you know, what a stupid target I would have been standing there, having never fired an AK in my life before. There's probably 20 or 30 ambushes all around me. Thank God I didn't. I just kept where I was. Then it all suddenly stopped. And I suppose 15, 20 minutes, I just didn't move. Because I didn't know what had happened. You know, they may have thought they'd killed everybody. And were moving off. And you know, if I'd stood up, they'd have killed me too. So I just stayed. And then I suddenly started to hear movement from the cab, and it was Tom and Mickey. And there were—I don't know how many dead there were. We lost people. There were the guys who jumped out, but those had been killed. Those who'd rushed into the bush rushed back again for us. We got out, ran off again with them, about 10 of them, and that was the start of what was quite a nightmarish 4 months, because the promise that we would go into Angola for 10 days to meet Savimbi turned out to be something like 110 days.